Iran marks the 33rd anniversary of a deadly U.S. strike on an Iranian passenger plane. President Rouhani calls on Washington to apologize for the crime. Thousands of South Korean workers stage a rally in the coronavirus-stricken capital of Seoul, demanding better working conditions. And the Al-Shabaab militant group claims responsibility for an attack in Somalia's capital Mogadishu that left at least 10 people dead. And welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran this hour, which has called on the United States to apologize for the downing of its airliner over the Persian Gulf 33 years ago. President Hassan Rouhani says the U.S. has failed to make a formal apology for what he calls a heinous crime. Rouhani says the U.S. must explain why it awarded the captain of the USS Vincennes, a cruiser that shot down the Iranian passenger plane on July the 3rd, 1988. He says the move to reward the captain was no way acceptable.
The U.S. brought on one of the deadliest disasters in aviation history 33 years ago on July the 3rd by shooting down an Iranian passenger plane. Iraner Flight 655 was en route from Tehran to Dubai. It was on its usual path when it was shot down by the U.S. Navy's guided missile cruiser, USS Vincennes, killing all 290 passengers and crew members on board. 66 children were also among the victims. The then U.S. administration claimed that the crew of USS Vincennes had identified the Iranian Airbus A300 as an attacking F-14 Tomcat fighter. Vincennes was traversing the Strait of Hormuz inside Iranian territorial waters, and at the time of the attack, Iraner Flight 655 was within Iranian airspace. Tehran declared the incident an international crime. It said even if the warship crew had mistaken the Airbus for an F-14, the tragedy was the result of the U.S. Navy's negligence and reckless behavior. Iran took its case to the International Court of Justice, but the case was settled out of the court in 1996 when the U.S. agreed to pay compensation. Washington maintained that the compensation was not a legal duty and was only based on an ex gratia. Although U.S. officials claimed the attack was a mistake, they never apologized to the Iranian nation and even awarded USS Vincennes commander Captain William Rogers. He was awarded the Legion of Merit decoration for what was described as exceptionally meritorious conduct in the performance of outstanding as a commanding officer of the Vincennes. The citation made no mention of killing innocent civilians on Iraner 655. When the matter was taken to the United Nations Security Council in July 1988, then the U.S. Vice President George H.W. Bush defended the Vincennes crew's action. He said, given the situation, the officers in question had acted appropriately. Bush noted, "I will never apologize for the United States. I don't care what the facts are." Succeeding American officials took the same approach. Over three decades on, still no justice for the victims of the one of the deadliest incidents in aviation history.
The Afghan Defense Ministry says the government forces have killed more than 300 Taliban militants in battles across several provinces over the past 24 hours. A local official in the province of Helmand also said that the Afghan Air Force has intensified its airstrikes against Taliban hideouts. The Taliban rejected the government's claims. Clashes have escalated between militants and government forces since May the 1st when the U.S. announced the withdrawing of its remaining troops from Afghanistan. The Taliban have seized dozens of districts in recent weeks. Washington has announced that it would finish its troop pullout before the September 11th deadline. On Friday, all U.S. and NATO troops vacated the Bagram Air Base near Kabul and handed it over to the Afghan army. Thousands of South Korean workers have staged a rally in the COVID-stricken capital of Seoul, demanding better working conditions. Protesters chanted slogans calling for wage hikes and measures to prevent workplace accidents. The rally in downtown Seoul was held despite a government ban on gatherings due to an upsurge in the coronavirus cases. Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom had also urged the cancellation of the rally, describing it as an extremely dangerous move that would add fuel to the flames of COVID-19. South Korea is grappling with a spike in coronavirus infections, largely blamed on the Delta strand. Now, the Seoul metropolitan area, home to over half of the country's 52 million population, is the hotspot of the highly contagious variant. The daily cases hit the highest in nearly 6 months on Thursday. Turning to Somalia, at least 10 people have been killed and dozens injured in a militant attack on a crowded tea shop in the capital, Mogadishu. The Ministry of Information, Culture and Tourism said the attack happened on Friday. It said that a suicide bomber detonated his explosive vest near the Juba Hotel. The Al-Shabaab militant group has claimed responsibility, saying the target elements from the intelligence and police. Al-Shabaab, which is fighting to overthrow the internationally recognized government, regularly carries out attacks against government and civilian targets in and around Mogadishu. And now to the United States, where more bodies have been recovered from the ruins of an apartment building that collapsed more than a week ago in the state of Florida.
Over the course of today's search, we did recover two additional victims. We now have 22 confirmed deaths, 188 people accounted for, and 126 unaccounted for.
Well, the mayor also said she has signed an emergency order to demolish the remnants of the building to ensure the safety of search and rescue operations. She worries about the stability of the still-standing partial tower. Paused search efforts on Thursday amid rough weather condition. Now the Champlain Tower's south high-rise partially caved in on itself in the town of Surfside near Miami. The cause of the incident has not been determined yet. Initial attention has focused on structural deficiencies described in a 2018 engineer's report. Going north from there to Canada now, where authorities are set to deploy military aircraft to help evacuate towns in danger of wildfires fueled by an unprecedented heat wave in that country. Officials say the armed forces have already been positioned in different regions for logistical assistance. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has also pledged support for the affected areas. Well, the record-breaking temperatures and wildfires have resulted in the forced evacuation of several cities in British Columbia during the past 2 days. Medical experts say the unrelenting heat has largely contributed to the growing number of sudden deaths in western provinces. More than 100 wildfires are burning through the region. Officials have warned about flooding from melting mountains in the west and new heat waves moving towards the central areas. Well, Russia has reported record COVID deaths for the fifth straight day, registering 697 fatalities during the last 24 hours. Health authorities also confirmed nearly 24,500 new cases on Saturday. Now, this is the highest daily caseload in the country since early January. The capital, Moscow, and the port city of St. Petersburg remain the epicenters of the new wave of infections, which authorities say is driven by the more transmissible Delta strand. A lagging vaccination drive has also worsened the situation. Officials have already said Russia no longer expects to meet its goal of vaccinating 60% of the population by the fall. Russia has so far confirmed more than 5.5 million coronavirus cases and over 137,000 deaths. However, some 12% of the population is fully vaccinated. Iran has registered 8,300 new coronavirus cases during the past 24 hours, bringing the total caseload to over 3.2 million. The Iranian Health Ministry also reported 111 new COVID-related fatalities. This pushes the total death toll in the country to over 84,000. Official data show that around 2.9 million people have recovered from the disease since the start of the pandemic. Meanwhile, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has warned of a fifth wave of the pandemic due to a more contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus, which first emerged in India.
In recent weeks, it has been announced that the Delta variant of the virus has entered the country from the south and southeast, and care must be taken not to spread it into the country.
Rouhani also advised citizens to remain vigilant and to observe health protocols to curb the spread of the new variant. Authorities have declared the capital, Tehran, and 92 other cities as high-risk red zones. Internal travel restrictions and the closure of non-essential businesses, among other restrictions, have also been implemented in the red zones. Iran launched its nationwide vaccination drive in February and has approved the emergency use of two of its indigenously produced vaccines. Iran is also working on five more homegrown vaccines. Nearly 6.4 million doses of vaccines have so far been administered across the country. Australia's New South Wales state has recorded its biggest daily rise in COVID-19 infections this year. Sydney, the state capital, has been hit the hardest in a flurry of outbreaks of the highly contagious Delta variant around the country over the past 2 weeks. New South Wales reported over 65 new cases in 2 days, taking the tally under the current outbreak to more than 250. State officials have warned that the next couple of days will be critical in terms of infections. While this comes as Sydney is halfway through a two-week lockdown, authorities say it is still too early to make a decision on whether to extend the lockdown. At least 43 asylum seekers have drowned in a shipwreck off of Tunisia while trying to cross the Mediterranean in an attempt to reach Italy. The Tunisian Red Crescent said another 84 people were rescued. The boat that set off from Libya's northwest coast toward Europe carried migrants from Egypt, Sudan, Eritrea, and Bangladesh. According to the Italian Interior Ministry, migrant arrivals fell during the past year, but numbers picked up again in 2021. Italy is one of the main migrant routes into Europe, which has recorded the arrival of nearly 20,000 asylum seekers this year. A UN report says at least 760 people have died while trying to cross the Mediterranean from Libya since January. Nearly 20 people have been reported missing in Japan following landslides triggered by heavy rains in the central prefecture of Shizuoka. Rescue operations are underway in the city of Atami. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga has also called for an emergency task force to tackle the crisis. The Japanese media say the raging waters have swept away homes and vehicles in Shizuoka. Weather Service has also warned about potential floods and continued heavy downpour in the upcoming days. Similar alerts were also issued in Kanagawa Prefecture. Last year, 50 people lost their lives in Japan following heavy floods and landslides that devastated the country's southwestern regions. Well, a volcano eruption near the Philippines capital has forced thousands of people from surrounding villages to flee. Authorities raised the alert level after the Taal volcano began spewing a 1-kilometer-high plume of toxic gas and ash into the sky. The volcano had been discharging sulfur dioxide for several days, prompting officials to issue a health warning. Some 2,400 people left their homes following an evacuation order by the government on Thursday. The country's seismology and volcanology agency say that they fear a magmatic intrusion at the main crater could further drive eruptions. Tens of thousands of people were forced to flee their homes after Taal erupted early last year, shooting lava 15 kilometers into the air and crushing scores of homes. Well, in Indian-controlled Kashmir, Srinagar, a young man has returned home after spending 12 years in an Indian jail. The man walked free after all the charges pressed against him were proven to be false. Our correspondent, Shahana Budd, brings us more from Kashmir.
Bashir Ahmed Baba is a free man now. 12 years back, he was detained at the Gujarat state of India for a crime he was unaware of.
I used to work for a German-based NGO. I and my colleague, who was non-Kashmiri, had gone to attend the training workshop on children with disabilities. It was a two-week-long program, but I was detained on the sixth day while my colleague was set free.
Baba was detained under a controversial Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, or UAPA, and was accused of making bombs in soft drink cans.
complete ho jaye aur
I was unaware of what I was being questioned about. I even couldn't read the charge sheet because it was in the local language. But one thing I was sure about is that one day I would walk free because I knew I was innocent. But I never knew it would take 12 years to prove it.
Unlawful activity is defined vaguely in the law as any action, whether by an individual or an association, which disclaims, questions, disrupts, or is intended to disrupt the sovereignty and territorial integrity of India, or causes or is intended to cause disaffection against India. According to the National Crime Records Bureau data, there's a rising graph of UAPA cases in Jammu and Kashmir. The UAPA law has come under stern criticism after several activists and journalists in India were booked under it by the Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party. Scores of Kashmiris are languishing in the jails across India. Providing legal aid and frequent meeting with the prisoners has become a challenge for their families. Analysts say unlawful detention is a violation of human rights and the covenants of civil and political rights say such people need to be compensated for unlawful detention and for those who have falsely implicated them also need to be tried in the name of malicious prosecution.
In India, in case of Muslims in general and Kashmiris in particular, the law enforcing authorities have been given a license to harass, implicate and detain without any cause. That is why we find Muslim population in India is just 15%, whereas 35% prisoners of India are Muslims and most of them are falsely implicated.
Sheikh added, Kashmir is an exceptional case where New Delhi has placed laws that allow authorities to detain people without any reason. Baba is happy to be back and is rejoicing the reunion with his family members. However, is in a constant dilemma where and how to start fresh. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
And with Shahana's report, it brings us to the end of this World News Edition from Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Theoretically, that nearly $1.3 trillion to be spent on national security writ large is supposed to be devoted to activities that make America and the world a safer place. That's visibly not the case when it comes to so many of the funds that will be expended in the name of national security, from taxpayer dollars thrown away on weapon systems that don't work to those spent on an unnecessary and dangerous new generation of nuclear weapons. to continuing to reinforce and extend the historically unprecedented U.S. military presence on this planet by maintaining more than 800 overseas military bases around the world. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written jointly by Mandy Smith Berger and William Harting, authors. This article is published under the heading U.S. nearly $1.3 trillion national security budget isn't making Americans any safer. Stay tuned for more. President Biden's first Pentagon budget, released late last month, is staggering by any reasonable standard. At more than $750 billion for Defense Department and related work on nuclear weapons at the Department of Energy, it represents one of the highest levels of spending since the Second World War, far higher than the peaks of the Korean or Vietnam Wars or President Ronald Reagan's military buildup of 1980s. And roughly three times what China spends on its military. Developments of the past year and a half, an ongoing pandemic, and intensifying mega drought, white supremacy activities, and racial and economic injustice among them should have underscored that the greatest threats to American lives are anything but military in nature. But no matter, the Biden administration has decided to double down on military spending as the primary pillar of what still passes for American security policy. And don't be fooled by that striking Pentagon budget figure either. This year's funding request suggests that the total national security budget will come closer to a breathtaking $1.3 trillion. That mind-boggling figure underscores just how misguided Washington's current security award that should increasingly be put in quotation marks, policies really are. No less concerning was the new administration's decision to go full speed ahead on long-standing Pentagon plans to build a new generation of nuclear-armed bombers, submarines, and missiles, including, of course, new nuclear warheads to go with them, at a cost of at least $1.7 trillion over the next three decades. In all, Biden's first budget is a major win for key players in the nuclear industrial complex, like Northrop Grumman, the prime contractor on the new nuclear bomber and a new intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, General Dynamics, the maker of the new ballistic missile submarine, Lockheed Martin, which produces sea-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, and firms like Honeywell that oversee the key elements in the Department of Energy's nuclear warhead complex. The Pentagon's proposed base budget, which in the past year has included routine spending for fighting ongoing conflicts, was $715 billion for the fiscal year 2022, $10 billion more than last year's request. Despite complaints to the contrary by advocates of even higher Pentagon spending, that represents no small addition. It's larger, for instance, than the entire budget of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. No question about it, the Pentagon remains by a long shot the agency with the largest discretionary budget. As for what's in the base budget, there are a number of particularly troubling proposed expenditures that warrant attention and congressional pushback. Spending on the Pentagon's new intercontinental ballistic missile, known formally as the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, has nearly doubled in the new proposal from $1.4 billion to $2.6 billion. This may seem like a small change in such a budget, but it's just a down payment on a system that could, in the end, cost more than $100 billion to procure and another $164 billion to operate over its lifetime. More importantly, as former Secretary of Defense William Perry noted, ICBMs are some of the most dangerous weapons in the world because a president would have only a matter of minutes to decide whether to launch them upon a warning of an attack, greatly increasing the risk of an accidental nuclear war based on a false alarm. In short, the new ICBM is not just costly, but exceedingly dangerous for the health of humanity. The Biden budget should have eliminated it, not provided more funding for it. Another eye-opener is the decision to spend more than $12 billion on the F-35 combat aircraft, a troubled, immensely expensive weapon system whose technical flaws suggest that it may never be fully ready for combat. Such knowledge should, of course, have resulted in a decision to at least pause production on the plane until testing is complete. House Armed Services Committee Chair Adam Smith has stated that he's tired of pouring money down the F-35 rat hole, while the Air Force's top officer, General Charles Brown, has compared it to a Ferrari that you don't drive to work every day, but only drive it out on Sundays. Consider that an embarrassing admission for a plane once publicized as a future low-cost bulwark for the U.S. combat aircraft fleet. Whether the Air Force, Navy, and Marines, the three services that utilize variants of F-35 will stay the course and buy more than 2,400 of these aircraft remains to be seen. Count on one thing, though. The F-35 lobby, including a special F-35 caucus in the House of Representatives, and the Machinist Union, whose workers build the planes, will fight tooth and nail to keep the program fully funded, regardless of whether or not it serves national security needs. And keep in mind that the F-35 is only one of the many legacies of failed Pentagon modernization efforts. Even if the Pentagon were to acquire its new systems without delays or cost overruns, something rare indeed, its expensive spending plans have already earned this decade the moniker of the terrible 20s. Worse yet, there is a distinct possibility that Congress will push that budget even higher in response to wish lists being circulated by each of the military services. Items on them that have yet to make it into the Biden Pentagon budget include things like, surprise, more F-35s. The Army's wish list even includes systems it claimed it needed to cut. That the services are even allowed to make such requests to Congress is symbolic of a breakdown in budgetary discipline of the highest order. The base budget also includes mandatory spending for items like military retirement. This year's request adds $12.8 billion to the Pentagon's tab. Theoretically, that nearly $1.3 trillion to be spent on national security writ large is supposed to be devoted to activities that make America and the world a safer place. that's visibly not the case. When it comes to so many of the funds that will be expended in the name of national security from taxpayer dollars thrown away on weapon systems that don't work, to those spent on an unnecessary and dangerous new generation of nuclear weapons, to continuing to reinforce and extend the historically unprecedented U.S. military presence on this planet by maintaining more than 800 overseas military bases around the world. Unfortunately, unlike the proposed Pentagon budget, significant Green New Deal-style infrastructure funding is far less likely to be passed by a bitterly divided Congress. Washington evidently doesn't care that such investments would also be significantly more effective job creators. Sadly, though, too many of America's political leaders have clearly drawn the wrong lessons from the pandemic. If this country continues to squander staggering sums on narrowly focused national security activities at a time when greatest challenges are anything but military in nature, this country and the world will be a far less safe place in the future.
Africa Today.
French President Emmanuel Macron says he recognizes that his country bears a heavy responsibility for the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, in which nearly a million people had lost their lives in a period of only 100 days. Now, during a recent visit to Kigali, Macron failed to meet the expectations of many who wanted him to apologize for the genocide. An activist working with Rwanda genocide survivors insists that France must apologize. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today. I'm your presenter, Mubarak Kenyam. Now, this week's edition is focusing on crimes by two major European powers in Africa. In the first segment of our program, we are analyzing the recent visit to Rwanda by President Macron of France, where he publicly acknowledged his country's terrible responsibility in Rwanda's genocide, but refused to apologize. In the second part of our program, we shall discuss the genocide perpetrated by Germany in Namibia over 100 years ago. Now, to compensate for its atrocities, the German government recently offered an apology and pledged 1.1 billion euros only in financial aid over a 30-year period. The descendants of the genocide victims have rejected the aid offer and are demanding full reparations.
We are living in poverty because of what they did to us at that time. Now we want them to restore our dignity. Reparations must come, and we want our land back.
Join us till the end of our show as our analysts delve deep into these two subjects.
Macron refuses to apologize over Rwanda genocide. Survivors of the 1994 Rwandan genocide say they're disappointed after French President Emmanuel Macron gave no clear apology over his country's role in the massacre of almost a million people in the African country. Speaking during a visit to Kigali last May, Macron claimed that France was not an accomplice in the Rwanda genocide and thus refused to offer an apology. The French president gave his speech at the Kigali Genocide Memorial Center at Gisozi, where some 250,000 victims of the 1994 genocide are buried.
Macron's visit follows the release in March of a report by a French inquiry panel that said a colonial attitude had blinded French officials and the government bore a serious and overwhelming responsibility for not foreseeing the genocide. However, the report absolved France of direct complicity in the killings. In April, Rwanda also released a report on France's role in the genocide against the Tutsi. For an incisive analysis on this subject, we have contacted Claude Gatebuke, a Rwandan war and genocide survivor, and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We also have with us here today Philip Rengens, an author and academic. He has acted as an expert witness on the law and politics of Rwanda, Burundi, and the DRC in national courts in several countries, and before the International Tribunal for Rwanda. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, let's start with you, Gatebuke. Why has Macron accepted French responsibility in Rwanda genocide, but refused to offer an official apology?
Since the genocide, there has been accusations, including court cases in France, where the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, has been accused of shooting down the plane of his predecessor, President Juvenal Habyarimana. And the shooting of the plane sparked the genocide. So the French have gone back and forth with the Rwandan government with a love-hate relationship. My sense is that Emmanuel Macron does not actually believe in what he's saying, because if he actually did, he would offer an official apology. But I'm sure he wants to leave this hanging over the government of Rwanda, that when they would like to bring up this accusation again of the Rwandan president shooting down the plane in the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which is the party in power, being responsible for the crime that started the genocide, that sparked the genocide, that they could still reopen the case.
Thanks for that. Now, it's quite an interesting viewpoint. Edige Nkuranga, the president of Ibuka, an umbrella organization that connects group aiding survivors of the genocide, has condemned Macron, saying he did not present a clear apology for France's role in the 1994 genocide. Let's now bring in Professor Rengens. Why did Macron refrain from apologizing over France's involvement in the Rwanda genocide?
Well, it may well be that he felt, and he will probably have been advised on that, he might feel that if you offer apologies, a claim for reparations might follow. Remember, the German government apologized for the genocide of the Herero in current-day Namibia, and Germany is now paying pretty hefty reparations. So I suppose Macron didn't want to expose France to a demand for reparations.
Countless thousands of children were slaughtered during the Rwandan genocide that was enabled by France. Proof of the carnage is still visible throughout the country. Across the country, individual killers carried out their work with unfathomable cruelty. A survivor explains here how children were killed.
Yeah, it was full of children, died. They took the children, they drop on the wall, they put on the wall, like this. You see, these are the blood of children.
If France was to offer an apology to Rwandans over the genocide, what would be the implications?
An official apology, I think, would the implications would be that whoever is a responsible party in the genocide, including France and anybody else that would be shown to have had a role in the genocide, they would actually have to pay reparations. They or their officials would have to be taken to court and face charges of genocide. And so I think that's a part of the reason why President Macron is avoiding an official apology. Although I do think that the government of Rwanda itself, the president of Rwanda himself, should also respond to the charges against him about sparking the genocide, because the genocide was sparked by the shooting of the plane, and a lot of his own officers have testified to it, including courts in France.
Official documents, survivors' testimonies, historic reports, books, and investigations have made available a barrage of information on France's participation in the Rwanda genocide. Researchers, however, estimate the classified secret documents in the government's archives still hide the truth.
Rwanda has long accused France of complicity in the 1994 genocide, but during Macron's visit to Kigali, President Kagame evidently softened his hardline stance. This is what he had to say after listening to Macron's speech.
His words were something more valuable than an apology. They were the truth.
Well, our last question to you, Professor. Why has President Kagame changed his previous hardline stance on France?
Well, I think both leaders had good reasons to try and establish normal relationships again. As far as Kagame is concerned, he has been, to some extent, I wouldn't say abandoned, but his usual allies, particularly the British and the Americans, have become more and more critical about his politics, about the level of democracy, human rights abuse, etc. It's also, I think, important for France because they have been, in part because of the conflict with the Rwandan regime, they have been basically out of Central Africa, or at least out of the Great Lakes region, which is an important region for them because it's a border between Anglophone and Francophone Africa.
Thank you very much, Professor Rengens. Professor is an author and academic, and he's also an emeritus professor of law and politics at the Institute of Development Policy, University of Antwerp. Now, back to you, Claude. Why is President Kagame eager to mend Rwanda's ties with France at this point in time?
Kagame's approaching of France is also a political move, because what has happened is, traditionally, Kagame has been a, if I can use this word, a puppet of the West. The way he's been basically a servant of Western governments, the UK and the US being the primary sponsors of Paul Kagame. And in recent years, they've started to distance themselves from Kagame and his government. And because of that, he's looking for new friends. And France itself is losing its influence on the continent of Africa, and Rwanda being one of the former French-speaking countries where France used to have an influence, I think France is trying to recover some territory.
France has deployed thousands of troops in several African countries to ostensibly battle terrorism. But despite this military presence, terrorists and bandits continue to wreak havoc in these countries where French troops are present.
Now, as we wind up, I'm sure you recall that the French military operation during the Rwanda genocide was carried out under the guise of a humanitarian mission. Is history repeating itself in other French military missions in Africa that are being carried out to ostensibly back terrorism?
You know, you look at so many places where they're involved in the Central African Republic, you know, how close they are with Cameroon and Chad and so many others, and you can tell their reason for being there, and in Libya and Mali and so many other places, their presence is problematic. Even in the Ivory Coast, their history there. It's been at a when the French go there, again, history repeating itself, they go there really to occupy, to take over, to take control of those countries, to install their puppet leaders, or to turn the leaders there, the current leaders, into puppets that they control, and then take control of resources. And they do not actually care about fighting terrorism or saving lives. They are there to serve the interests of France, which are purely economic interests and not interests of saving human lives or even fighting terrorism.
Well, you have it there. France is pursuing selfish economic interests in its renewed engagement with African countries. Thanks a lot for your analysis, Mr. Claude Gatabuke, a Rwandan war and genocide survivor and the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss the rejection of Germany's genocide deal with Namibia. So don't go away.
Bolivians reject Germany's genocide deal.
From 1904 to 1908, German colonizers waged a brutal campaign of genocide against the Herero and Nama people in present-day Namibia. It was estimated that 65,000 of the 80,000 Herero, that is around 80% of the Herero population, were killed during the genocide. Some 10,000 of an estimated 20,000 Nama were also brutally killed by German colonial forces.
More than a century ago, after these atrocities it committed, Germany has now issued a late apology and promised development aid to those affected. Foreign Minister Heiko Maas says that Germany for the first time recognizes that it had committed genocide in Namibia during its colonial period. Many Namibians have rejected the so-called development aid being offered by Germany as compensation for its colonial-era genocide. A Namibian politician says Germany perpetrated the genocide and can therefore not purport to make a just and neutral decision on reparations.
Germany has been dictating. And for me, it was like a case of you have a murderer or a rapist, and this person is the one to decide whether I have raped or not, and should I find myself guilty, what could be the best punishment or verdict that I can give myself? So that is how the whole process was not acceptable to us.
Now, for an incisive analysis of this subject, we contacted Dr. Muginde Kajiua, Secretary General of the Oba Herero Traditional Authority. Thanks a lot for joining us today, Doctor. Now, can you first briefly elaborate to us on how the Nama and the Herero genocide took place in present-day Namibia during the German colonial rule?
The Nama and the Herero genocide is a genocide. The German government issued two extermination orders, written, translated in local languages, distributed, and then they implemented their intention as planned or as intended and carried out to the letter. Rounded Hereros and Namas refugees or prisoners of war, put them into concentration camp, ensure that they are put to heavy labor and also hanged, make sure that the population is reduced. In fact, at the end of the genocide, General Lothar von Trotter stated that the Herero nation would never continue to exist as it was. He has completed his role, his job successfully.
Thank you for that, and we'll be back with more.
Germany agreed to pay Namibia 1.1 billion euros as it officially recognized the Herero Nama genocide. Angela Merkel's government claims the payment amounts to a gesture of reconciliation, but not legally binding reparations. Herero and Nama leaders dismissed the deal as a public relations coup because it did not include funds deemed reparations. It has also been hugely disappointing to the Herero and Nama that the funds will be distributed over a period covering three decades.
The Herero chief, Bekui Rukoro, who died recently of COVID-19, was leading fierce opposition to the offer by Germany. He accused Germany of pursuing a racist policy by refusing to negotiate directly with those affected by the genocide.
And the only difference, Germany is continuing to refuse to sit down with us as victims of their genocide and extermination campaign is because we are black Africans. So it's a racist policy.
Now, Germany has offered a 1.1 billion euro settlement, which has been rejected by the Herero and Nama leaders. Why have they rejected this deal?
We cannot agree to a product within which we are excluded. And in any case, the amount of money that they have agreed to is a slap in the face, is an embarrassment for the Namibian state. is not even the value of land, over 50 million hectares of land confiscated in Namibia equates that much. The land alone that is taken by the colonizers, it's about 75 billion euros. And let alone the 100,000 lives that are lost, the displacement of people in the neighboring countries.
Descendants of the affected communities rejected the text of a joint declaration between the Namibian government and Germany, which omitted the word reparation. They also called for the renegotiation of the agreement with a focus on increasing the financial amount offered by Germany.
Now, what do you think should be done for justice to be served to the Herero and Nama people?
We have been consistent that we must revert back to the National Assembly resolution, which was unanimously adopted by the Namibian Parliament, which says the victim communities, the two governments must sit around the table, and the victim communities must be represented by their chosen leaders as victims of genocide, and they must propose to negotiate a package that addresses the needs of the victims wherever they are. So the negotiations must start afresh. We will not accept what is on the table.
Now, as you continue the struggle for the rights of the Herero and Nama communities, what's your message to the international community?
We're calling upon the international communities, peace-loving people, people that are fighting for justice, restorative justice. We're calling on that community to support us in our struggle for restorative justice. We hope the national governments will put more pressure on Germany to recognize the genocide and pay reparations. We will continue this fight. We will bring it to the United Nations, to the governments of the world, to ensure that Germany is pressurized through political pressure and negotiations that recognizes genocide and pays reparation that is due to the victims of genocide in Namibia.
Well, thank you very much. The Secretary General of the Herero Traditional Authority in Namibia. Now, here at Press TV, we shall continue updating you on the continued struggle for reparations by the oppressed Herero and Nama communities in Namibia. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. And please, do send us your comments through our social media handle. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone.
Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.